a lot of the food that I make on the website is exploratory, and I'm doing small batch things, maybe in the restaurant kitchen, maybe at home, but it's kind of like an idea of what food could be, or examples of fun things that people could make at home. It's really whatever I want. The restaurant needs to be a little bit more focused. If I put milkweed pod curry on the menu, you think the guy pulling up in the Maserati is going to buy milkweed pod curry? No. He's going to be like, what the fuck is chef thinking? Why? You're going to kill me. Serving milkweed pods, you will kill me.
The mushroom has a tremendous problem-solving ability. And because we can talk to it, we can ask it questions. We can actually get a non-human perspective on human problems.
Well, hello, hello, my little mushroom munchers. I hope you are doing fine on this fall day. Doesn't feel like fall in Kentucky here, but according to the calendar, it is. Maitake season is starting to unfold. Seeing a lot of pictures rolling in. Chanterelles are done here in the east. It's fall picking time. Got me a bunch of chicken of the woods last week. Oh, the day before I left for Jamaica. It's bound and determined. Get out there and pick. Got about 30 plus pounds of chicken in the woods. Saw a couple of young hens starting to unfold. What else did I get? Got some honeys. What else? There's a couple of varieties that I snatched up, but the chickens were the big ones. And then this weekend, my son and I picked about 15 pounds of Amanita muscaria, variation Guasaui, something like that. Yeah, I will be working with them. A friend of mine, who you may have heard his episode, has a product that he makes out of Amanita muscaria that is quite interesting and completely legal. So, yeah, well, you may be able to tell from the intro to this podcast that this is going to be full of some laughs. Had a excellent conversation with Chef Alan Burgo. Didn't know what to think as it got started. It starts out a little slow, you know, it's kind of awkward sometimes having these conversations with people you've never really interacted with, and you just sit down over a computer and try to find common ground and take interest in each other. But it really didn't take long. Alan is a fascinating character. He's got an amazing website, theforagerchef.com. That's how I came across him. And does some really top-notch work. Beautiful blog. His blog is hilarious. He's just got a great personality, and I truly enjoyed this conversation. Bear with the first, 10 or 15 minutes as the connection via Skype wasn't 100%, but then it kind of leveled out, and the sound quality gets a lot better. The conversation flows a lot more smoothly. Don't let the first few minutes discourage you, because this was a hell of a conversation. Really, really enjoyed it. So, what's going on with you? Hope you're picking some shrooms. If not, I hope you're eating some shrooms. And if not, I hope you're interested in some shrooms. And if not, then what the fuck are you doing? I mean, come on, these things are amazing. Even if you don't eat them, they are truly profound, truly awe-inspiring, and an essential element in our environment. So, much love to the mushroom. I just got back from Jamaica, and that was a wowzer of a trip. Did two private retreats that were, it was really outstanding. Outstanding. I'll probably talk more about those on the podcast that I'm recording tomorrow. So here in the next few weeks, you might hear more details about that. Excuse me. It was an amazing trip. very unique, and very deep. So, yep. I have got so many podcasts recorded and lined up. I'm super excited. I am super excited that Wednesday is my final day of probation. That's right. I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm maybe a little ashamed. I don't think I'm even ashamed. It's just like turns my gut, you know, to think that I was arrested, locked in behind bars for a week, put on house arrest for, what was it, like 3 months? Probation for 2.5 years, and spent a ton of money getting out of this or dealing with it. Didn't get out of it, dealing with it. And yeah, this phase is finally drawing to a close. I'm hoping that it initiates some real positive things in life. It's been a struggle. So Wednesday, September 27th, is my last day of probation. Oh, man, I've never even been in a cop car. You know what I'm saying? I haven't had a speeding ticket for like probably over 7 years now, and all of a sudden I got slapped with a felony. So anyway, if you would like to support the causes that I am working towards and that many of you are working towards as well, then you can go check out pledge.org. That's PLEDG.org, Psychedelic Liberation Education, Discipline, and Guidance. You will find the work that we're doing. You will find that you are capable of donating to Pledge and participating in it if you like. You can see what we're doing there to educate and affect some change culturally, and then eventually laws will change around that. You can go check out the work that we're doing at Michael Meditations. Many of you know about the therapeutic aspect of my mycological work. That is mycometeditations.com, M-Y-C-O Meditations. We got a couple good retreats coming up October, just kind of a standard group retreat. November, we've got a extremely special retreat coming up with researcher Catherine McLean from Johns Hopkins and comedian Shane Moss of the Here We Are podcast and hilarious Shane Moss stand-up comedy. He just did a big tour in the States, 111 cities. It's called A Good Trip, educational and comedy around psychedelics. Now he's touring Australia. Well, he's leaving for Australia. Excuse me. Coffee's got me going. He's leaving for Australia to tour that continent in a couple weeks. And then he will be joining us in Jamaica. We are about halfway sold out. I expect in the next month and a half that those tickets will really start to move. It's $26.50. It includes 2 gourmet meals a day, your lodging, your ground travel, a massage session with a professional masseuse, 4 psilocybin sessions with myself, Shane, and our other facilitators. Catherine's presenting her research twice. Shane is giving 3, I think, entertainment sessions, dividing his bits up. He's got quite a bit of material, really. He's got a lot of experience with psychedelics. People who are maybe have been dealing with some really deep depression, and Shane is totally... What I love about Shane and respect about him is he is wide open with the stuff. He talks on his podcast about his struggles and how psychedelics have assisted him. So I really respect that guy. And then we got a DJ party on the full moon night. I'm going to be giving presentations on the history of psilocybin and the modern research. We will talk cultivation of gourmet mushrooms, legal mushrooms, but that knowledge is broadly applicable. And we guess that, like, there's some day trips that can be taken optionally, like to some really cool little waterfalls and tourist sites. So it is going to be 10 days chock full of good stuff and psilocybin. I mean, like, some people have said, oh, $26.50 plus I got to pay for a flight. You're going to be staying on the beach with a private pool, you know, like with all of this entertainment and activities, meals. I mean, it's going to be outstanding. I have no doubt about it, and I'm super excited about it. So if you are interested, I suggest you get going on the application on michaelmeditations.com because it's going to sell out. It's already halfway there, and we still got 2 months, actually, looking at the date. It's the 26th to December 5th, November 26th to December 5th. So we've got 2 months and one day before it starts. All right, well, I'm going to let this conversation with Chef Berg go get going. It just really was a pleasure, and he is just a heck of a guy. Really enjoyed your conversation, Chef, and your blogs, man. They're hilarious. You guys check out theforwardyourchef.com. Link up with him on Facebook. He's already got 10,000 plus followers there. He's doing some really, really cool work. And I'd love your feedback on this episode. If you'd like to hear more chefs, I think this is an aspect that maybe I need to, really dig into. But I always want feedback. And I always want to give shout-outs to those people who have been of encouragement or like financial encouragement or energetic encouragement. I'm going to shout-out Brian Lockler again. Not only did he donate to the Patreon like a month or so ago, he messaged me and said that he wished that he could have donated more, which, again, any amount counts. It helps. I don't care. Especially Patreon. You know, it's a monthly thing. It adds up. If 1,000 people were to donate $1 a month, there's so much that could be done with that. We will turn this into a video podcast. There's just, like, I got tons of ideas I'm not going to go into right here that require financial support. So, Brian Lockler, and he said, I thought this was quite interesting, he started listening for the psychedelic content, and now he's loving the gourmet. It's funny how things work, you know. I started loving gourmet mushrooms. Well, I don't know. I like trip mushrooms, and then I got into gourmet mushrooms, and then I really got into psychedelics. But I definitely would say that the gourmet medicinal mushrooms were my first mushroom love. The psilocybin mushrooms, that was all about enhancing my creativity, you know. So it wasn't really the mushroom that was the focus, it was the effect. And then I got into all these others, found out how amazing they are, and then that led me to deeper explore psilocybin, and that rabbit hole doesn't seem to have an end. So Brian said, like I said, he started with psilocybin content and now is interested in gourmet mushrooms. That happens more often than you might think. And it happens the other way around too, just like my example. And then Mr. Michael Weiss, who was a guest on the podcast and is also owner of the Mushroom Life company, the Mushroom Life, he donated a decent amount. That's going to be... Actually, it already went to purchasing 2 mobile recorders with lapel mics, and they will be put to use tomorrow. We're going to do our first podcast recorded live while hunting maitake, and that excites the shooby-dooby out of me. Something I've been wanting to do for a while. And so, Michael, your donation played a large part in that happening. So, all right, well... You know how it goes. I'm going to see you on the other side of the shroom. And when we get there, will you be taller or will you be smaller?
I'm here today with Alan Burgo. Is that the pronunciation, Chef?
Burgo. Yeah.
Burgo. Chef Alan Burgo, who is the Forager Chef. I've been following his stuff on Facebook for quite a while. You do some pretty awesome work, man. I really, really appreciate your blog, especially. We'll get into that a little bit more later. Why don't you first tell us about your first mushroom memory.
My first mushroom memory. Well, I think technically the first memory would have to be when I was a kid eating white button mushrooms out of a can. And that, I think that is the first memory of a mushroom that I can possibly think of.
So it maybe is not the first fondest.
You know, I really liked them. I loved the mushrooms out of a can when I was growing up.
Right on.
But my first memory with wild mushrooms was, I mean, well, the memorable one was I was out frisbee golfing, and we came upon a big chicken of the woods, and it was the first time that I, like, realized I had just been cleaning that in a kitchen, like, a day before, and then we came upon a big one, and I knew exactly what it was.
Ah.
And it was the first time where it kind of clicked, you know?
So you were cooking wild mushrooms, you had experience preparing them, and then you're out frisbee golfing, and you start coming across them and recognize them, huh? So the kitchen was kind of the first interface.
Yeah, so I was really, really lucky in that I was working in nice kitchens. So what happened is that instead of buying a guidebook or something first, I got spoon-fed all the really good species. Before I had ever researched a matsutake, I'd cleaned 100 pounds of them. Or chanterelles, or lobster mushrooms, or ten of the woods, or most of the really well-known edible species. I had already cleaned, cooked, and prepared them because people were bringing them in.
Okay.
So I got shown how to cook them first. So I really, you know, had that intimate, that hands-on knowledge before I ever started looking for myself.
Right. So tell us a little bit about your culinary background.
Well, I started cooking. I got grounded when I was 15. I was a bad kid. And my grandma brought me a cookbook, and I started making pasta. And then I wanted to keep making. The first thing I got into was Italian food. And then I went and talked my way into kind of the nicest place in the area. This is like 2 hours west of where I am right now. It's a place called Wilmer, Minnesota, where I grew up, like 18,000 people, really small. And that was like the first kitchen that I worked in. It was the late 90s. Everybody was really hot on Anthony Bourdain. It was interesting. You know, we were still putting balsamic reduction on everything. That was still really hot. And then from there, I went to college to go to business in the Twin Cities. And again, I just went and talked my way into working for a guy that owned his own restaurant in Rome for 10 years. His name was Angelo. I worked for him for 2 years. And then I kind of got into the circuit of Italian chefs in the Twin Cities. And then I went to work for a friend of his that was from Milan in northern Italy. I worked for him for a year. Then I worked with a butcher from Rome for a year. Then I worked for the former personal chef to the Princess of Monaco. He was from Como, Italy. I worked for him for a year. Then I was the sous chef at an Italian restaurant in downtown St. Paul for 2 years. Then that place closed. I opened up the brand new Heartland, which is Lenny Russo's restaurant in Lower Town, St. Paul. Menu changed every single day. We didn't use any ingredients greater than 200 miles of Minnesota. And, I mean, I think it got nominated for the James Beard Award 8 years in a row. And that, I left that, opened up the Salt Cellar, which is kind of this funky steakhouse concept that I got into the owners with coordinating with Lenny. And then that closed, and then I just took over last year, Lucia's restaurant in Minneapolis. It's been around for 32 years.
Okay, so you've worked your way through the ranks. Then you weren't like trying. You didn't go to culinary school, the ACI or anything.
Nope. No culinary school.
Oh, respect that. So when you guys at these early restaurants, when you were seeing wild mushrooms coming in, where were they? Were they locally harvested, or were you buying them from big distributors?
Most of the time, they're going to be locally harvested. I do have a friend in Oregon who, he's like an 80-year-old farmer, and he'll ship us stuff from Oregon once in a while. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll get Boletus Rex Varus in the spring from him. We'll get cauliflower mushrooms sometimes, and then the Cantharellus formosus, the Pacific Northwest kind of typical chanterelle from out there. We'll get those sometimes because I can get them all from him. When we get, you get like a 50, 60 pound batch, I can get them for, you know, maybe even under $10 a pound. And that's a steal. You know, people around here, around in Minnesota, they're going to try to sell chanterelles to you for $25 a pound.
Right.
That's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. That was an issue that I often ran into with Shebs, as, you know, that not being able to get the price that I wanted, because of the bigger distributors from out west. I mean, it's just a reality, you know. Excuse me, I'm so stopped up. I got a head cold just came on me last night. But, yeah, it's I think that pickers have a misunderstanding of the value of the product, really, you know.
Absolutely.
So how do you deal with that interface with pickers? Or when they're disappointed, you just, you know, sorry, guys, this is what it is? Or do you try to meet them as close as you can to what they want?
Well, I try to meet people as close as I can. What I do is I have a couple people that I work really closely with. Mm-hmm. Some of them don't really want money. They just want to eat. So I'll pay, you know, $40 a pound in gift certificates.
Right.
And some people, you know, older retired pickers, they are just tickled, and that's fantastic for them. Younger pickers, they want money.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get that from me. Most of the time, people still need to be taught cleanliness with harvesting, you know, that the attention to detail. The pickers that are older and retired, and especially the ones from Eastern Europe that I work with, they clean the mushrooms for me.
Right.
Like they clean them all.
Yeah.
And I mean, I got a delivery of boletes the other day, and my lady Olina had taken every single bolete and putting it into its own paper bag after she cleaned it, you know, with hundreds.
Wow.
That is ridiculous. You're not going to get that with your younger millennial pickers out there trying to get a buck, you know what I'm saying? But I've taken a couple of the younger pickers under my wing to try to teach them, this is how you trim these, this is how you clean these. Don't try to sell somebody dirty mushrooms. Mm-hmm. And in return for me giving you some advice, you're going to bring me little small batch, you know, stuff that you find. You know, maybe it's Romaria botrytis that I'm probably not going to put on the menu, but I'm going to eat that myself. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's some fried chicken mushrooms that we don't see very much around the Midwest, and they can be kind of a bugger to identify, or their beefsteak mushrooms, you know, which I'm probably not going to get a large enough amount to put on the menu.
Right.
So I try to have a network of people to help me find the interesting species, and then I can point them in the direction of big co-ops and stuff that will pay that $20 a pound, $25 a pound.
Okay.
I'll pay 10.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, identification is really only half of the story when it comes to selling wild mushrooms. I have seen some horrible, horrible things taken to market, and chefs that,
oh yeah,
sometimes the chefs don't know better, or these are private clients that don't know better. And then they, you know, they have contacted me and said, you know, what's up with this? I'm like, well, it's rotten, you know, chicken of the woods that are,
yeah, it's crumbled. Gross.
Yeah. It's horrible. And it, I mean, one bad mushroom experience can ruin someone's, interest in wild
forever
mushrooms. Yeah, for life, you know. So it's really important that we educate people on the quality, and I love to hear how you know, the varieties of mushrooms that you are aware of are do you have any botanical background? Have you, you know, studied biology? Is this all self-taught?
I've never studied biology. It's completely self-taught.
Man, that's beautiful. You're I'm really impressed with just the quality of the work you're putting out, and like how you're talking about coming through the culinary field, just, you know, from the ground up and learning all these various mushrooms, man. Wow, it's deserving of respect. So you had mentioned, and something that I've encountered as well, the kind of frustrations with the legality of selling wild mushrooms and people who will like bootleg shit or just like over harvest, irresponsibly harvest. What do you experience up there in Minnesota?
Well, the big thing that I see is, I'm not going to name any names.
Yeah, probably.
But so. we got this harvester up here. He's got a company, and I mean, I was a member of the Wild Mushroom Advisory Committee. We advised the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Minnesota Department of Health on the legality of mushroom laws and like what should be legal. What species should you be able to sell? Who can buy the species? Who can sell the species? If someone is certified to sell mushrooms, you know, what does that really mean? Can they sell to a chef that is not certified? If the chef is certified, can he buy from someone that is not certified?
Right.
Like all these kinds of little ins and outs and intricacies of the selling game. But basically, we got a guy who started out as a picker and now has his own business. He's had a couple of them. Some of them have failed. Besides being a complete blowhard, he has classes that he teaches. After he got into a fight with the U of M, a lot of the certification courses are taught at the U of M. But this guy gets into a big fight and smears them in a magazine article saying that they don't know what they're doing. Then he starts going to the University of Wisconsin to teach certification courses. And the biggest thing that he's fighting for in these certification courses, well, he's making money off it, but then he's saying you can never, ever harvest off of public land and sell. And I know guys that have picked for him, a couple different people, and it's like, where do you think most of these mushrooms that this guy is selling is coming from? And he's selling to a lot of places, but it's super hypocritical to tell other pickers, you can never pick something off of public land and sell it for profit, when that's like, that's your bread and butter.
It's his model, you know? Right?
That's the only thing that really, really kind of irks me.
Well, what do you think about public
picking? We do public picking.
Yeah.
You know, I see both sides of it. I used to, when I had more time, you know, before I was an executive chef, when I had more time, I was a line cook and I didn't make any money at all. Mm. You know, I'm making like $14 an hour trying to get 32 hours a week if I'm lucky. You know, living in my friend's basement, I first saw mushrooms as, hey, maybe I can make some extra cash here because I'm broke as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I can really see both sides of it. And, you know, the side of the picker trying to make some money, or someone that really likes to hike or something like that. If you don't pick the mushrooms, it's pretty likely that they're going to be past their prime by the time someone else has picked them, or they're just going to rot and go back to the ground. On the other side, you know, on the side of the state that owns the land, it's public land. And should someone be able to profit off of public land, and what sort of activities does that encourage? You know, competition over public land, especially like with morel spots. I mean, I see death threats online every year.
Yeah.
You know, like, get out of my morel patch. This is them's fighting words.
Yeah.
You know, so I see both sides.
Yeah. I kind of like, you know, I tried to start the wild certification program in Indiana when I was living there. I've worked kitchens, mainly line cook. I was a manager for a brief period of time, and was a mushroom cultivator for, I don't know, 10 years or so. And we tried to start this program in Indiana, recognizing the need for some kind of standards. And my proposal was, you know, a permit, really. I mean, because like you're saying, there's two sides to this story. You know, there not only when we leave the mushrooms out there, you know, nobody's enjoying them, nobody's getting the health benefits, but also when you're picking mushrooms and carrying them through the woods, you're spreading spores. So, you know, to a certain degree, you're actively seeding if you are intelligently harvesting the mushrooms at the proper period and your harvesting practices are, you know, correct. So, but if, you know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with if people pay for a deer hunting permit, you know, and that's just food they're going to eat. And so if you're picking mushrooms, you got a 10-pound chicken in the woods, you're going to try to sell for $15 a pound. I mean, it only makes sense that the state who owns the land should get a cut out of it. And like, it would be a great opportunity to help the states understand the value that their forests have.
Exactly. That's a great point.
Well, in Kenya, they actually, I think it was Kenya, pretty sure. They found that the harvesting and export of chanterelles was more valuable than the timber. So it's happened, and it's a proven
more valuable than timber.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, I mean, you're picking matsutake now. Shit, that's one of the most valuable exports coming out of the U.S.
Absolutely. One of the most difficult to find.
Well, let's talk about that, because I have never been so fortunate to even taste matsutake. And I like to hear people tell their stories, because it just whets my appetite all the more. And the matsutake you're finding, they weren't known in the area. Is that correct, until recently?
That is correct. So someone else has also found them. I mean, kind of in the public eye, it's me and this one other person that have found them here. And he had them sequenced. So they are more closely related to the Japanese species.
Right.
But basically, the matsutake, I mean, I'll be honest and tell you, I had looked for them myself. I had always thought, hey, this would be really cool. And this is the matsutake, my picking them is really, it's a testament to the power of communication online and really to the network that I've built. I mean, I thought that I was going to be, you know, kind of maybe chit-chatting with some Minnesota mushroom pickers once in a while. And, you know, very, very quickly, in the span of a year, I had, you know, friends from Alaska to Germany to China to Australia talking, and we're all talking about mushrooms. It mushroomed very fast. Yeah, and I had someone come out of the blue, and they were like, "Chef, I've been picking matsutakes in Wisconsin, and I'd like to bring you there." And that was it. And then from there, I did a post about them. And then I started getting emails in with ID requests. And then I could sift through those. Mm-hmm. And I would say, oh, yeah, I can come up to your property in northern Minnesota and check that out for you. Sure. Yeah. And now there's a couple different places. And yeah, they are a fascinating mushroom. I never would have thought, ever would have thought that we would see them here.
What kind of
halls? It's pretty cool.
What kind of halls are you getting? I mean, and how long now have you been picking matsies?
2 years.
2 years, and what's your poundage pool?
I mean, the halls. Yeah. The halls. I could I could be getting more right now. It's my time. My time is so sparse with the restaurant. You know, I'm still pulling like 70-hour weeks. It makes hunting, taking time to hunt mushrooms really, really difficult. You know, a pound or two here, a pound or two there, a couple pounds, maybe five, I think 5 pounds is probably the most I've found. The other guy that picks them is, you know, he's hunting to sell them. So he's picked enough to sell to restaurants.
Right.
But me personally, strictly personal consumption amounts.
Oh, you're not even putting them on the menus at your place, huh?
Not yet. We'll see how much time I have to pick this year.
Yeah.
It's the spots are like, you know, they're like 4 hours away from where I live.
Right.
And I don't have anyone to watch the line for me at night. Mm-hmm. So it's like I have to get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning, drive, try to get back for service at like maybe 1, and then stay until 11 o'clock at night. It gets to be long, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally get it. I mean, I've reluctantly had to give up a lot of mushroom picking this year because of my personal business, just taking up so much of my time. But, you know, it is what it is. I'm going to get out for hens here in the next couple weeks. I got to leave the country on Friday.
Good for you.
Oh, man. You guys are getting get those up there, yeah?
Oh, we're bumping with hens right now.
Yeah, it's early, right?
Yeah, it has been early. I'll tell you, my early patches had been a little spotty, and kind of the big ones, they haven't really started to get their engines going yet, mine, but
all right.
They're all so different, you know.
Yeah.
We'll start seeing them in some trees. We'll start seeing them in the beginning of summer here.
Really?
Yeah.
Not
tons.
I got my fingers crossed that my heavy producers will be, I get back the 21st, so I think I should be
safe on that.
Getting all this rain coming up from Irma that will just fuel it for the next week and a half. So, now you mentioned a unique chicken of the woods that doesn't grow in a shelf form.
Yes.
What's that all about?
Yep. I've never heard of it documented. I have never seen it in a guidebook, but I have cooked it and I've eaten it, and one of my friends has picked it. Another chef friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
That's the closest that I have to like concrete evidence. So basically, it's a chicken of the woods. And they came into the restaurant one day. I mean, there's like 12 of them, and they were all like orbs. Just they had convoluted, like convolutions, like a brain.
Yeah.
And they were pretty cylindrical. Some of them were kind of ovoid, but you could see they had a spot where the root was cut off from the bottom. And then they grew up like an orb, like circular, like there was no shelf.
Huh.
Or anything like that at all. And I would say like, oh, maybe that was an immature, you know, cincinnatus.
Right.
Because they grow in the basal rosette form. Mm-hmm. And it was so big that it just hadn't grown yet. Or it was a huge chicken that just hadn't grown yet. But it was yellow. You could see the pores were obviously yellow, like yellow when you slice it all the way through.
Uh-huh.
And there was like, you know, the first time was like 7 or 8 of these orbs. So it was not just one, you know, freak.
Yeah.
It was a whole bunch of them. But they were circular, growing directly from the ground, not from, you know, not from wood. So probably over a root,
right,
or something, I would assume. And they were orb shaped, and it's a variation that I thought was so amazing. You know, I took it for granted at the time. I was like, oh, great. You know, we'll cook these again next year.
Mm-hmm.
Never seen them again.
Oh, man. So you didn't get photos or anything?
Oh, no, nothing. Nothing. Oh. I'm just kicking myself.
Man, there's so much out there to be discovered in the world of mushrooms. I think that's kind of like the most exciting thing about having the increased interest in our population is that it's going to hopefully reveal new species and
yes,
new formations.
Exactly.
You know, and you said you have had you've picked some species that have been typified. Like you've described new species. Is that right? What was
I haven't personally. I have not connected with people at the U of M to do the sequencing. Okay. I sure would like to.
Okay, I thought you'd mentioned
All I have are suspicions.
I know. Well, that's enough to go. It's a good start anyway.
So one of them is the chicken of the woods. And then another one is a giant kind of variation of aborted entoloma.
Okay. So
I'm not a mycologist.
Right. No. And there are a lot of people out there claiming to be mycologists that are purely not. It drives me crazy, man, when I just like a random person says that they're mycologists. They have like no degree. They just have been hunting mushrooms for 10 years or whatever. Like, okay, cool. You know some mushrooms, but let's get our terminology straight. You're not a fucking mycologist. Were mushrooms the first wild food that you got into, or did they lead you down the path of other wild foods?
They were the gateway drug.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. The mushrooms were the beginning. And, you know, just like any other mushroom picker knows, you might want to go out for hens next week, but there's... You know, with some of the species, you can be reasonably certain, but there is no guarantee.
Mm.
You know, with something like plants, you know, I'd go out, I'd strike out for mushrooms, and I didn't want to go home empty-handed. So I'd be like, well, what else can I pick? Right. It's basically, when I was at Heartland, I would bring stuff in, I'd get up, like, early every day, and I would go out and hunt like every day because we wrote the menu every single day. And I would write, I mean, on my station, I'd have four entrees, half of two different tasting menus, four side dishes, and that was the huge saute station. So I'd rewrite the menu every single day, and I'd want to put in whatever I could find as much as possible to play around with. And if I struck out on mushrooms, I wanted to see, well, what else can I bring? Maybe I can pick these crab apples, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I started wanting to learn about plants. And it just kind of, you know, I stumbled over a block of ice and found this iceberg underneath. And I just wanted to, have consolation prizes is what the plants kind of became at first. Now, I will say it's almost, you know, what I've been trying to learn is almost kind of done a 180-degree shift, because I can have people bring me mushrooms all day long.
Yeah.
But my salad mix that I pick, that's like 10 different species of wild greens, I'd have to pay someone like $40 a pound to pick that. And no one around here that I know is going to forage plants for you. Besides the random thing like nettles or amaranth.
Right. Y'all get ramps, I guess, up there in the spring.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, ramps.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those are so popular. I forget. Sometimes I forget they're wild. You know.
Well, what percentage of your menu, and is it Lucia? What's the name of the restaurant you're at right now?
Yeah, it's Lucia's restaurant in Minneapolis. Kind of the founding restaurant, really, of, you know, working with local producers in the Twin Cities. Okay. So I mean, it's the most venerated kitchen in the Twin Cities, 32 years. Were you gonna ask what's the percentage of wild food on the menu?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. So. like a lot of the food that I make on the website is exploratory, you know, and I'm doing small batch things in maybe in the restaurant kitchen, maybe at home, but it's kind of like an idea of what food could be or examples of fun things that people could make at home. It's really whatever I want. The restaurant needs to be a little bit more focused.
Uh-huh.
If I put milkweed pod curry on the menu, you think the guy pulling up in the Maserati is going to buy milkweed pod curry? No. He's going to be like, what the fuck is Chef thinking? Why? You're going to kill me. Serving milkweed pods, you will kill me. There has to be a balance, is what I'm trying to say. So, I mean, mushrooms, people are pretty accepting of wild mushrooms because let's be honest here, like people that hunt wild mushrooms that know and appreciate them, we're probably, as far as like a percentage of the population, we're talking about chefs and we're talking about people in the mycological society and we're talking about the random belly feeders here and there. We are not the majority.
Right, yeah.
And that's easy to forget when all of your friends like to pick mushrooms. You know?
Yeah, I do know, yeah.
Yeah. So we got to remember, I mean, well, for me, as, you know, someone who is purchasing food for people, for, you know, hundreds of people a week to ingest, my product mix has to be balanced.
Yeah.
Wording is very important. And if I put wild foods on the menu, they need to be in an accessible format. And you really, I'm saying from experience, people are not ready for it yet. I mean, in some places they are, like, say, like, you know, Noma is the best example. But the places like that are few, very obviously very few and far between, because the general population is not ready.
Yeah.
They are not primed for it, and they still are looking through plants of the lens of that is a weed.
Yeah.
That is not that is like half vegetable, half plant. It's like that is a weed. That why would you eat that? That's right. Like eating roadkill.
Put dandelions on the yeah.
No, oh my God, no.
You did what?
Yeah, this has to be a balance.
Yeah.
So I'm very, as far as the percentage is not very much. The percentage of local food that we thoughtfully source is very high. And I would say a good 75% is what I shoot for, which is difficult. Because just because something is produced locally, it doesn't mean that it's better. They're not, you know, always concurrent.
Right.
You know, I was buying melons last week, and the local melons were twice as expensive, and they were shit.
Yeah.
So we didn't have melon on the menu. For example.
So I got two things that I don't want to get past here that you got me thinking of, and one is, are there regulations around other wild foods in restaurant cuisine? Like wild game or wild plants. I know, you know, mushrooms, you got to have a certification, et cetera, but.
With wild game, that, as far as I know, is a state by state deal. So in Minnesota, you can't go and shoot a deer and bring it into a restaurant.
Okay.
You can shoot a deer and bring it into a processor and have them process it for your own personal consumption and make your meat sticks, your chops, jerky, and all that. But serving in a restaurant, absolutely not. Okay. And I agree with that. You know, we don't know what's got chronic wasting disease, and some wild meats can be dangerous.
Right.
Especially if you're going to try to cook them like medium rare.
Oh yeah.
Now, if something has a kill step, and you're bringing that up stew, you're going to bring it all the way up past the buck 55 and, you know, kill everything that is heat sensitive, then maybe there would be a little bit of wiggle room, especially if somebody signs a waiver. But as far as I know, in Minnesota, there's no serving wild game. It has to be farmed wild game.
Okay.
That means the venison that you serve is going to taste really mild, and it's going to be very, very tender.
Right.
Not necessarily a bad thing, but also not really truly representative of venison, in my opinion. As far as plants, it's the wild, wild west. There's nothing.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. No, nothing. Oh. I mean, like I said, mushrooms, you're technically supposed to have a permit, but I can tell you that if the chef knows what the mushrooms are, sometimes when I was selling mushrooms, I could convince chef that I knew what the mushrooms were, and I would sell them whatever I wanted.
Right.
You know, I was out to make a buck.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's all about reliability.
Yeah. At the end of the day, that it definitely is. But there's, you know, the health department, unless there is like some kind of big stink or somebody calls on you.
Right.
Which I have had happen. The biggest delivery of morels that I ever saw in my whole life. A bunch of Canadians came down in a caravan and they had 100 pounds of our local morels. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen that many. It was amazing. You know, they're all like this big.
Oh, wow.
Somebody got jealous from the Mycological Society and called the health department, and the restaurant that got raided for morels, which are our state mushroom.
Right. Yeah, I saw that in Indiana about 6 months ago. A chef buddy of mine up there, he got popped. Somebody called in on him for serving puffballs, I think. And because now there's like people are trying to get this certification, and there's a whole, you know, competition among pickers about who can sell. Because, you know, if you certify 100 people in 3 counties, like 4 of those people are going to be able to sell their product. You know, somebody's got to be the bulk buyer or something. So it's even within the cultivation, man, it's like there is a real misunderstanding about the profitability. You know, the demand is not there yet for mushrooms to be highly profitable. And then if you look at production costs, at least in gourmets or even your time in out picking, the average person can't go spend 6 hours looking for 5 pounds of mushrooms. You know, you got to be making paying the gas, feeding yourself, the fucking fall and break your leg or some shit out in the woods. Like, it's over. It's all she wrote. So the other question I want to ask is, like, what is just your goal with the Forager Chef persona? Is this just an educational venture, or is there some other kind of long-term vision for it?
Oh, well, I mean, I'd say it's definitely educational. That's one of the goals. Education for myself, education for other people, to kind of see that, you know, the resources for cooking with wild food, there's getting to be more. I mean, like, you got my friend Hank Shaw has a great website too. But, you know, historically, you like wild food cookbooks or anything like that are really bad. Like, really bad. So, you know, wanting to help people in a format and a dialogue that doesn't cost them anything is something that I wanted to do, because I, you know, I don't make any money. I don't charge anything. It's free info out there for people to take and pick through as they choose. The other thing it does is it functions as an electronic business card.
Yeah.
For me personally, you know, I don't make money off of it, but I have intangible benefits.
Right.
Like I said, with the matsutake, people send me messages online. from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like every corner of the freaking world. It's that's what I never expected. Never expected that Australia's mushroom season is in our winter. Things like that. And, you know, people from Britain showing me how to use the GPS to zoom in and look for rings all through the internets, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So how long have you had this, the Forager Chef? Has it been online?
I think it's been a good 6 years now.
Okay. I really enjoyed your blog, man. I don't read a lot of blogs, but I came across, I read yours as prepping for this, and very well written, with some humor thrown in there. Your personality really comes through. The photos are great. Really appreciate it, and I strongly encourage anyone listening to this to go check out that blog and some of your videos. What are some of the stranger non-mushroom items that you've prepared at home?
Well, the strangest was when I flew down to Florida to shoot a TV pilot with a Vietnam vet that trains the SEAL team that took down Osama bin Laden in pre-black powder survival techniques. Went down to Florida, this bumfuck nowhere Florida, and we're going to hunt squirrels and shoot a TV show about it. And this guy's name's Madison Parker. You can look him up online. He's got this thing called Bulletproof Kennels, and he makes his own slingshots. He takes deer down with a slingshot.
Slingshots?
Headshots.
Wow.
Yeah. Like I said, he trains the Navy SEALs.
He trains
SEAL Team 6. Okay. Like they all come out to his Quonset hut that he built. And he makes his own spears, and he hunts squirrels with a team of pit bulls and guys with slingshots. They all have these slingshots, and they triangulate on the squirrels in the tree and shoot them out of the tree with these slingshots. The slingshots, it's not a slingshot. It's like a silent pistol. So that was pretty cool. Last week, I was eating groundhog, and that was the best. That was the best I've had. Best game I've had.
Yeah, I had groundhog.
Tender.
I was like,
kind of like braised duck.
Yeah, I had a guy serve me fried groundhog one time. I grew up in the country, as most people can discern from my accent, and we had the opportunity to eat squirrel and raccoon and groundhog. I never ate possum, and I'm pretty confident that I never will. Right on. Yeah, the peacock story interests me. I never one time
that was good.
Eating a peacock.
Yeah, and I had always wanted to eat a peacock. And then my girlfriend's mom said, "Oh, our friend has a whole bunch of garlic at his farm. He's got peacocks, too." And I say, "He's got peacocks? How many?" And we start a conversation, and they had these peacocks there, and they were, one of them showed up one day, and they were from someone else's farm, and they thought, "Oh, the peacock is so pretty, we should get it a friend." Well, they got it a friend, and then they made more peacocks and more peacocks, and if you've ever heard the sound that they make, it's like a prehistoric screaming animal flying through the sky. It's a horrible sound.
Yeah, it's horrifying. Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Well, so you get to fulfill that wish. How adventuresome is your girlfriend with your foods?
Oh, very, very much so. I'm sitting here on her farm right now. She grew up on the farm. She's a writer, but she's very very, very appreciative.
And right on, right on, right on. So
she'll try anything.
Yeah, groundhog. She do groundhog.
She loved it.
Really? Well, that's you got an adventurous woman there. and you got Lyme disease, right?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I've
heard some stories. Yeah, I had the episode I published last week. Michael Weiss, who's a mushroom wild picker, he had some horror stories from Lyme disease, and it fascinates me because I have been bit by ticks like thousands upon thousands of times, and I can't believe that I escaped that. But it's something like people should really be aware of when they're out picking, that this is not a fucking joke.
It is no joke. Experience? It is there. It is real. So my experience, I was leading a foray with some people, and I got a deer tick on me. I picked that sucker off. I know that's the one that it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd picked them off before and just not really thought about it. It'll never happen to me. Mm-hmm. That stupid, ignorant mentality.
Yeah.
And then I was cooking a Luxinum, Scaber stock. And I undercooked it a little bit. I was pouring boiling broth over it, just a couple slices. And it made me sick. And I thought, man, I started like looking into it. I'm feeling really, really bad. And I'm really, really feeling bad. And, you know, past the gastrointestinal stuff, I'm feeling this lethargy. I can't get out of bed. And I'm like, this Scaberstock mushroom has really fucked me up. So I got to go to the ER. Like, I'm going to have renal failure or something. And I go to the ER, and then they're like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. I told them what I had been doing. I was like, yeah, I was out in the bush, like, picking mushrooms for the last 2 weeks straight every day.
Right.
They didn't even think to give me a blot or anything like that. They're just like, no, you just have the flu. Go home. So I go home, living in my friend's basement, and then I wake up in the middle of the night. I know something's not right. I go look in the mirror, and it's just the solid ovals all over my body. So then I'm like, okay, I got Lyme disease. No insurance. You know, as a line cook, I wasn't making any money.
Right.
And I went in, thankfully got on the doxycycline. But what really got messed up was that the Lyme, I'd been suffering from something called cluster headaches when I was younger. Like, it started when I was like 17.
Yeah.
And it's basically like 1 month out of the year, I would not be able to like drink any alcohol. And I get these horrible, horrible headaches that are like right behind my eye. Mm. And they're really, really bad. Like, I can't drive. It gets sensitive, really, really sensitive. And I can't function at all. The Lyme disease interacted with it, and it kicked it into overdrive, and it made them chronic. It was like somebody flicked a switch in my brain, scrambled my brain with an egg beater. And I had the cluster headaches. Instead of having them like 1 month out of the year, I would have them 5 to 6 times a day. And they were paralyzing. I had, it went so far that I had to get a prescription for, an oxygen tank to bring with me on the line at the restaurant with a mask.
Yeah, I've seen that.
While I was expediting tickets.
Shit.
And it was like, I was not going to be able to go on like living like that with like six. The attacks can last 2 to 3 hours, and I'm getting like 5, 6 a day. Eventually, I figured out that I can exercise and make the pain lessen, or even abort the attack if I get my heart rate up to like a buck 90.
Yeah.
So I do military exercises. I do burpees. But the way that we kind of got them under control is my girlfriend hooked me up with a neurologist from Florida called David Perlmutter. And now I take like 15 different herb supplements twice a day. I started taking them. 2 weeks later, the headaches were gone. After years of battling them.
How soon was the onset of the Lyme disease after the tick, the bite?
Three, 4 days.
Oh, really? That quick? Wow.
Yeah, it was quick. It was quick.
Well, it sounds like you caught it early enough anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't get into my spine, thankfully.
Right. Wow. Well, that kind of segues into another topic I want to discuss with you a little earlier than I had anticipated, but it's consistently shown that psilocybin is one of the most effective treatments for cluster headaches. I don't know if you've seen any of that. Like every 6 month dose of psilocybin is supposed to be really effective at alleviating those symptoms. And, you know, I'm not asking about any illegal activity or suggesting any, but it is an interesting connection that you bring up. Do you have thoughts on psychoactives?
Yeah, it is
Go ahead.
I absolutely do have some thoughts. I mean, before I found out about the exercise and before I found out about all the herbal supplements, I did all the research that I could, and I started seeing there was the study that everyone talks about. They did at Harvard with psilocybin, and I think it was psilocybin and cluster headaches they were doing at Harvard, but don't quote me on it. But there's been a couple different studies and experiments with people using psychoactives to work with cluster headaches and a whole bunch of other, you know, disorders and
right.
and things that happen to people. So I was like, oh my God, I need to get some mushrooms. It will cure me. Unfortunately, I wasn't 18 anymore and I didn't have any connections.
Yeah.
So I taught myself to grow them under my bed.
Ah, okay. So you took it into your own
hands. Yes, because, I mean, I had the pain of the cluster headaches is so bad that, you know, any sort of conventional or illegal painkiller, they did nothing. Mm-hmm. And I was just miserable. So I tried growing a couple different species and I tried it out and it did not seem to help.
Really?
In fact, the worst time was I took them and they would invoke the attacks.
Oh, shit.
And one of the last times, like 4 years ago, I tried to take some to kind of, you know, like dose myself so that it could like last for a few months, like the effects on my brain and my circulation. Mm-hmm. And it kicked me into the worst cluster headache attack of my life. And it lasted like 3 days straight.
Wow.
It was horrible.
Did you, I'm assuming that you didn't report this to any of the institutions that have done psilocybin research?
No.
No. That's an interesting case. I mean, I didn't tell you in the emails. I'm pretty, sometimes depending on the individuals that I'm working with, I don't unveil it right off the bat, but I lead legal psilocybin retreats in Jamaica. That's Myco Meditations is a company that I take people down who are suffering from PTSD and cancer anxiety and whatnot. And we have a whole 7 to 10 day program working with wild Jamaican psilocybin mushrooms. And it's been really,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's been beautiful. We've seen a lot of progress. I will say that one of the only conditions that I have not seen consistently improved by psilocybin is migraines and headache issues. So it'd be interesting to look into that. I know I have definitely seen research that indicates, you know, massive benefit from psilocybin for cluster headaches, but I've never heard someone actually have the condition worsened by consuming psilocybin. So that's pretty fascinating.
Yep.
But yeah, Michael Meditation,
but,
reflecting on mushrooms in general. So it's a broad, I hope to eventually have, you know, this be kind of an ethnomycological center. We do serve, you know, mushrooms as part of the meals. I'll bring down dried maitake and chanterelles and whatnot and kind of mix those in with the Jamaican cuisine. So that's kind of a neat little flair to it as well. You mentioned Amanita on your blog. I saw where you said you have you said you have also purchased those from legal vendors. What's your experience been with that?
So I have this was back in the days when I was not making money as a line cook, and I actually did not purchase them from any vendors. I was the vendor.
Okay.
So yeah, so you were
harvesting and selling? Oh, really?
Yeah. That did not make people too happy. Another thing that I don't usually volunteer to bring up, but I think I'm in good company here.
Yeah. No, so, well, I mean, I've eaten my fair share of Amanita, and it's not something I would recommend, but I wouldn't necessarily discourage it either. It's Muscaria, Amanita muscaria. Amanita as, and I want to talk about this, Amanita is a deadly genus, that there are some valuable edibles in that genus. Have you worked with many edible Amanitas?
Yes. Grisettes.
Uh-huh. Do you guys get the versions?
I mean, they sell grisettes canned in France. They're in the supermarkets.
Really?
But those are really the only ones I've eaten besides Muscaria for culinary value.
Uh-huh.
You know, my harvesting Muscaria, drying it, and selling it to the local Wicca shop is, you know, us trying to make a buck. And people, they sell out every single year.
Yeah.
They take pre-orders, and they have a whole bunch of different harvesters that bring it into them.
Did you ever consume any?
Not really something I have not. I have not. What was it like?
Man, I ate them three different preparations. When I was on psilocybin one time, I found my first Muscaria, and the next day I ate one full cap fresh, which was a horrible idea. I did no research. It was all bad. Like, hypersalivation, sweating, blurred vision. It was all bad. Yeah, I was resigned to the fact that I was going to die. But I did.
Yeah.
Don't do that, folks. Don't try that one. And then I've dried caps and eaten those in modest amounts, and they've been just a mild kind of dreamy euphoria. But what's most interesting is I have a friend in Indiana who is an MD up there, and he developed a method of decarboxylating the abotenic acid so that you're getting pure muscimol, and it is a beautiful, profound experience that it feels like it is really doing some real healing on the neurological system. There's a very little information known about muscimol as far as its effect on the brain. We know that it's a GABA analog, so it operates on the GABA system, which is a neuroregulator. It regulates synapses. So there's actually a lot of potential for muscimol in elderly populations to improve focus and brain function. And we're hoping, we're still kind of trying to find a way to take this product to market. But it's a pretty involved process.
That's cool.
Oh, it's, and I mean, just like a half to one fluid ounce of this concoction, it can be like a really profound and very interesting. And if you consume it with psilocybin, then you can feel the both, because psilocybin's operating on serotonin and muscimol's on the GABA. So you can feel them both working separately, but in tandem. In
crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome. So what about you? Had also, while we're talking about semi-poisonous mushrooms, I was really fascinated by your blog on Gyromitra.
Yeah. Okay. So how that came about is, I mean, once again, the website, it functions as like a beacon, and it brings people to me. It brings information to me more than I ever would have dreamed of. One of my friends that I've gotten from that is an older mushroom hunter, and he knows mushroom hunters older than him. I mean, he's one of the most respected people in our mushroom community around here. I won't use his name, but he knows who he is. And one of his friends is, you know, he's old. He's got to be 80, 90. And he is a doctor from a very, very Finnish family, and has lots of memories of eating mushrooms in Finland. And he can't hunt mushrooms anymore because of mobility. He can barely walk. So my friend puts him in his truck, and my friend drives the truck around. And then the old guy says, "Oh, stop here. Here's this patch. Stop here. Stop here." And he takes him in his truck with him. And then my friend gets out and picks the mushrooms for him. And then they all go back, and then he goes home. But the doctor was the family doctor of my friend's wife. And as a child, he would cook her family Gyromitra, their favorite mushroom. And this guy is like 80, 90 years old. He's been eating them his entire life.
Huh.
And I thought it was fascinating. I started talking to my friend about it one day, and he's like, "Alan, have you ever tried Gyromitra? My wife used to eat them as a child, and she really liked them." And I started thinking, man, that is so fascinating, because I know people eat them, and I know that information I can see the, you know, the search terms people use to get to, you know, posts that I've done, and I can see like posts on morels or Gyromitra. I would see every year from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you know, hundreds and hundreds of searches for best way to cook brain mushroom, best way to cook Gyromitra, best way to cook false morel. And I know it's kind of well known up here that people on the UP eat Gyromitra, and they eat a lot of them. Wow. So I know that's going on. I have a friend on Facebook who is a professional mushroom hunter, and he said that they shipped 9,000 pounds of Gyromitra Montana to restaurants in Florida. What? Last year. 9,000 pounds.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So tell the listeners that maybe some aren't as familiar with Gyromitra and the cautions around it. I mean, for one, it's like producing rocket fuel.
Exactly. But the mushrooms, that they are producing rocket fuel, so you want to par cook them. You boil them, and then you fry them afterwards. But the real bugger with them is, depending on the mushroom, the mushrooms, different species of Gyromitra, have different amounts of these compounds that could hurt you. And you really don't know how much gyromitrin they contain without, you know, doing some like real in-depth laboratory research with them. But kind of the one gyromitra that's accepted to, none of them are accepted, but the one that people say that you can sell is Gyromitra Montana. And that, I mean, supposedly, I'm not an expert, supposedly that is supposed to contain the least amount of gyromitrin possible. And I will tell you, they taste very good.
That's why I'm laughing, because I'm thinking about your blog and how your description of sitting there in the corner with the towel over your head is insane. Yeah, it's pretty good, man. Pretty good. Well, I don't know that I'm ever going to try those, man. I don't know. I mean, I guess, like, if if it was Montana, because down here we're getting the Helvetica, I think it is. You know, I don't know, man. And I know, like, if you eat just small amounts, then the risk is minimal. You know, it's the long-term exposure that is what I've read is the real concern. But, you know, I don't want to fall in love with a mushroom that I can't eat regularly.
And that, too. Fair enough. You know, it's not something I'm going to go out and, you know, eat every spring. I'm going to go to my morel patches. Yeah. But, you know... When I think about mushrooms and different species of them, I look to Europe as, you know, I get so much information and inspiration from the old European cultures. You know, they really have a lot of wisdom, old wisdom to share with us about these things. And, you know, you can take and leave what you like, you know. I'm not going to go out and eat Gyromitra every year, but I might find some recipes that Spaniards use to cook saffron milk caps and think that's really cool, or how Italians like to cook porcini, or how the French like to cook the black trumpets. You know, there's a lot of really good information from European countries because they've been eating mushrooms and lots of them for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a perfect lead into the last thing that I really wanted to get into, and that is the cultural impact of wild mushroom hunting here in the U.S. and maybe some of the changes that you've seen or trends that you've seen over the years. It's bringing up, like you did about Europe, it's so fascinating to me. Or I went to China a few years back and just seeing how in love with mushrooms the Chinese are, you know, and like what a
in love.
Oh man, what a quality of life it brings to their everyday existence. You know, there's this organism that they just like really engage with and they view as a central part of their culture. And I'm starting to see here in the States that we're picking up on that. And I'm really interested in someone like yourself who's been so involved in wild mushrooming and the you know, popular foods over the years, what you've seen in regards to a cultural transition towards mycophagy.
Well, the one thing that I do know is that every year more people are brought into the fold. More people are brought kind of into the know that, hey, this is really special. This is fascinating. You know, consuming wild mushrooms, you know, can give you tons of health benefits. First and foremost, from a belly feeder like myself, they taste really good. What's really interesting is we're seeing like a gradual paradigm shift in American culture, because we are a culture that is historically fearful of mushrooms and is really the opposite of where we come from, Europe, which loves mushrooms. So somewhere along the way, what I suspect is British influence, we became scared of mushrooms, because the only real culture in Europe that is kind of classically scared of mushrooms is Britain. You know, so somewhere along the line, our point of view got a little bit tainted. But I know every year more and more people start to get involved. More and more people get interested. It's really a burgeoning industry, hobby, and pastime. And once you get into it, it's hard to turn a blind eye when, you know, you go outside and everything's like a magic eye painting.
Yeah.
So it's only going to grow. I'm waiting for more people to poison themselves. Because that's going to happen. Yeah. You know, people are going to want to experiment, and the nature of humans is they're human. Yep. So people are going to make some mistakes, and we're really just going to have to kind of ride the wave with that. It'll be what it'll be. I'm kind of worried about my personal mushroom spots, to be honest with you, because every year it gets a little more competitive, and I find that I have to seek out private land locations more and more. And it is what it is, you know. Part of being like a champion of not being afraid of mushrooms means that I'm trying to help people enjoy mushrooms, which means that I may have to watch out for my patches.
Give up some of the gold. I feel like, man, my chanterelle patches last year, I went out and, like, I went to three different spots. Well, I went to several different spots, but three of my 10 or so spots had people in them picking at that moment, and I was just like, you know, well, I've picked so many chanterelles from these spots over the past 15 years, so I guess I can humble myself a little bit. But, you know, you build a relationship with these patches, and one of the things cultivation taught me, and it also rings true with mycorrhizals, you know, you have these perennial patches of mushrooms that you consume them year after year, or you have mushrooms that you cultivate from clones year after year, day after day, and they are the same organism. You know, like when you eat a chanterelle from that patch around those oak trees for the 15 years, you're not eating like a different apple from a different tree. You're consuming the same specimen, the same organism for decades, and like it really becomes a part of your body. And that's what was hardest for me to give up, is that these organisms that I had such a deep relationship with, that now people who maybe definitely they don't, there's no way they could have that same intimate connection. I would go to my chanterelle patches, you know, before they're fruiting or after they're fruiting, and just sit in the patches and know that the mycelium is there underneath me, and that, you know, I believe that the mycelium is aware of what's going on around it at all times. So there's a communion there that is so special, and giving that up is really like, that's the sacrifice. I'm happy for other people to eat mushrooms, but you know, some of these ones that I've known for so long that are not a part of my body anymore, it's a little heartbreaking.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So anyway, all right, Alan, well, I know you are a busy, busy fellow. You have been an excellent guest. This has been a great conversation. And I'm hoping that as this podcast grows, that I will eventually be able to do some traveling for it. And I would love to get up to your restaurant one day, maybe do a little live podcast, let you cook me up some Jawaramaicha or some weird, or some Matsutake. That's what I want, is some fucking Matsutake.
Yeah. Yeah, let's be honest here. Get the Mopsies.
All right, my man. Well, I sure do appreciate it. Let's tell the people if there's any other contact information. The Forager Chef is your website. Facebook is Forager Chef as well, right?
Yes. Yep. That's foragerchef.com online and on Facebook.
All right, man.
That's pretty much it.
Cool, brother. Well, keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, man. You have a great rest of your day, and I hope to chat with you again here in the future.
Well, there it is. I hate to say I told you so. No, I don't. I love it. I love it. I told you so. It's a great episode. Just get past that little bit of audio improvement needed. I think I figured out what's going on, or at least one aspect. So hopefully next week. Well, not next week. It'll be a minute because I got several recordings that are already done this way, but I promise I'm getting better as I go. Love you guys, and I hope to hear from you. See you next week. Much love.